Today on Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, the neglected art of living in the now.
What I mean by practicing the present is a habit of intentional awareness, where we make ourselves aware of what's going on in the moment. We make ourselves aware of God. It's a kind of what I might describe as it's a habit of seeing.
Welcome to Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Five Love Languages. Today, author and former professor and pastor, Dr. John Kessler, will help us live not in the past or for the future, but right now. His latest book is our featured resource. It's titled Practicing the Present, The Neglected Art of Living in the Now. You can find it at fivelovelanguages.com.
Oh, it's going to be a great conversation, and I hope it will encourage you if you feel like you're always racing ahead and worrying about what might happen next. Gary, you strike me as somebody who naturally tries to live in the present as much as possible. Is that true? And if so, how did you learn that, or is it in your DNA?
Well, Chris, my schedule is of such a nature that I have to live in the present. I don't have time to think about what's happening tomorrow until I turn the page to tomorrow. And that doesn't mean that I don't have plans for tomorrow, because I've got, you know, a lot of things scheduled out 2 years if God lets me live. But I really do, for the large part, live in the present. And, you know, I'm excited about this conversation, because I think there are a lot of folks who don't live in the present. They're living in the past, and sometimes with regret, or yes, are they living in the past with, you know, how wonderful it was back then, rather than where they are now, or focusing on the future. So I think that's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, one of those struggles is, if I make it to this point, you know, if I get married, or if I get out of school, or if I, you know, get that job, or whatever it is, we live racing towards something that is always in front of us. So if that is you and you're struggling with that, or the regret thing, listen to Dr. John Kessler, K-O-E-S-S-L-E-R. He is faculty emeritus of pastoral studies at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, where he served as professor of applied theology and church ministry for 25 years. He's the author of a number of books. We've talked about The Radical Pursuit of Rest here, The Surprising Grace of Disappointment, A Stranger in the House of God, and there are many others. He's a contributing author to the Moody Bible Commentary. He also serves as a contributing editor to Moody Bible Institute's Today in the Word, where you can read his monthly Theology Matters column. You can find out more about him and our featured resource, which is Practicing the Present, at fivelovelanguages.com.
Well, Dr. Kessler, welcome back to Building Relationships.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Last time you were with us, you talked about the radical pursuit of rest. And I wonder if there's any correlation between our inability to rest and our struggle with living in the present.
Yeah, I think very much so that there's a connection. In fact, I think the key to living fully in the present really requires resting in God. And you really described well the two tensions that we feel, the one where we feel connected to the past and often with a sense of regret over what's been, or maybe we feel a sense of anxiety about what might happen or what's going to happen, or even a kind of urgent desire to get into the future. All of that can distract us from what God is doing in the now, and largely as a result of our inability to rely on Him and even to have a sense of the reality of His presence.
Well, you talk about living in the present, and we have a vague idea, I think, of what that means. But what is really at the heart of that concept?
Well, let me start with a negative definition of what I mean when I'm talking about living in the present and say what I don't mean. I'm not talking about forgetting the past, or living in what we typically describe as denial about what's happened in my life. In fact, I really think that practicing the present is just the opposite. Because we're believers, we have this rich history that shapes our present experience, and remembering is an important part of that. You know, the Bible talks about it frequently. I'm also not talking about dismissing the future, you know, where we just sort of we just sort of forget about, we say, well, we're not going to think about, what is that line from Gone with the Wind? You know, I won't think about that today. I'll think about that tomorrow. Jesus taught us to pray into the future when he taught us to pray, thy kingdom come. What I mean by practicing the present is really a habit of intentional awareness, where we make ourselves aware of what's going on in the moment. We make ourselves aware of God. In a way, it's a way of locating ourselves in the world. It's a kind of what I might describe as it's a habit of seeing.
Mm. My wife has sometimes made the statement, wherever you are, be all there.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Does that fit into this concept?
Yeah, I really think it does, because it is very easy for us when it's easy for us to be detached. You know, we're doing something, but we're not really engaged. We're not really focusing on, we're not concentrating our attention on the here and now. And I think also, you know, often we're either trying to get away from the circumstances that we're in. So we don't like the situation that we might be in. And so we're either dreaming about the past, we're sort of fixated on the way things used to be, and usually more often it's the way we sort of think they used to be. They often really weren't as good as we remember them. Or we're dreaming about the future, you know, and either way, it's a kind of a fantasy world that we're locked into.
Yeah.
But the reality is that God is at work in the now. God is at work in the real circumstances that I'm in. So part of practicing the present really is this discipline of taking stock of things as they really are. You know, what's the real landscape of my life? What do things really look like? And we're doing more than assessing when we're doing that. We're trying to keep our eye open for God to recognize that he is present. He's always present, ever always present in our lives, and to get a sense of where he's moving and how he's moving in the here and now.
Yeah. What led you to explore this topic and later write this book on living in the present?
Well, you know, I think it was partly a function of my own life stage. You know, as Chris mentioned a minute ago, I just this year retired from the faculty at Moody Bible Institute. And as I was starting to approach retirement, you know, I kind of felt like a person who's driving really fast and is running out of roads, you know. And when I began to look at my career as it was coming to an end, it was a little disturbing to me to realize that this future that I had been planning for most of my professional life had pretty much come and gone. And then I also found at the same time that I was dwelling more and more on the past. And I kind of wondered, what was all that happened in between, you know, between the past that I was remembering and the future that I was hurrying toward? What was all that in the middle? Where did all that go? And why wasn't I paying attention to it? And, you know, was that just empty space? And it dawned on me that to some extent, the past and the future are really both shadows. One's a shadow of what has been. The other's a shadow of what might be. But, you know, as far as my lived experience, it always unfolded in the now, which I think often I was dismissive of. I didn't pay that much attention to it.
What do you think's the biggest challenges to living in the present as opposed to the past or the future?
Well, I think it comes from a couple of directions. Negatively speaking, you know, I think on the one hand, those of us who are locked into the past, most of the time we're locked in either because we think that the past is better than where we are now. So we're looking back on it. We're kind of like, you know, we're kind of like the Israelites who they're longing for the flesh pots of Egypt, you know,
and yeah.
which is, for if you think about it, the irony of that is it really wasn't that great. You know, they were slaves. And I think that's often true of us, that the past that we are longing for is one that is we view through this filter. Or it's the opposite, is that we have this conviction that the future is going to be so much better than where we are now, either because the now is uncomfortable and we're trying to move into a more comfortable space, or we've got this great vision for our lives, and so we're in a rush to get there. I also think, you know, talking about the past, that there is some of us are fixed on the past because there's something back there that we are really struggling with. Maybe it's a decision we've made, or it's something that's happened to us, and we can't move past it. We can't get beyond it. We're still sort of stuck there trying to really not even process it. We're just sort of living through that again and again as we dwell on it. So I think those are the two forces. One is either this sense of longing or regret, and the other is a sense of haste. You know, we're in a hurry to get where we're going. We're so focused on the destination that we really don't enjoy the journey. We're not really interested in it.
Well, yeah.
I wrote this down, Dr. Kessler, when you said keeping our eyes open for God. That's really what you're talking about. And I like that. You know, right now, as we are having this conversation, that can happen if I'm alert to it. But I want to ask you a controversial question. You know, anytime you talk about practicing the present, this question of the East or Eastern mysticism, is this just, are you just dressing Eastern mysticism up for the church family?
You know, there is a meditation practice that has its roots in Buddhism that's known as mindfulness. And actually, you will hear a lot of believers talking about this, and in some books that deal with spiritual disciplines, they actually use the language of mindfulness. And I do think there may be some overlap when it comes to some of the practices or some of the disciplines that people use when they're engaging in mindfulness, what's called mindfulness. But I think the biggest distinction between what I'm calling practicing the present and what's traditionally been described as mindfulness is God. You know, coming out of the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness really doesn't have anything to do with God. Buddhism as a religion in general is essentially an atheistic religion. And mindfulness is a discipline where somebody uses meditation to focus on the self. And I think for many people, it's a technique that they use to try to arrive at a certain state of consciousness or a certain kind of experience. Practicing the present does involve a kind of self-awareness, but it's primarily focused on God. It's not just focused on myself or my surroundings, and it's certainly not trying to create a meditative or a blissful state. I think for me, it's simply a matter of noticing the reality of the ever-present God in my life and in my circumstances.
Looking back on your interfacing with students, do you think students grapple with this living in the present?
I think with students, you know, everybody sort of has a bias. I think that students tend to be biased toward the future in their role as students. That is to say that they're preparing for their career. They want to know what somebody said to me years ago. They said, you know, college students only have two questions that they want to know the answer to. One is, how do I determine God's will, and who am I going to marry? Which the two are related. and I've actually found that's kind of true. You know, that they do tend to have a kind of a focus where they are eager to move into what's next. They're kind of always preparing for the future. I think that's especially true in a school like where I taught at Moody Bible Institute, where we're training people for ministry. You know, it's easy to think that the most important things in my life are all going to happen after I graduate and begin my career and in ministry. And So the danger there is that they don't see how God is working in their lives right now. They don't see how serving God is just, is not something that they're going to do at some vague point in the future, but God's working in their life and he's using them right now. At the same time, yeah. I would say that you find more and more students today who are coming out of backgrounds where they have been hurt. They've been scarred by their family background. And I think for those students, often they are wrestling with the past, or they're trying to work through the issues created by either some significant trauma or consistent family trauma that they experienced. And so, in a way, everybody wrestles with it, but students are certainly not immune to it.
Is it harder for those of us that are older to live in the present, or is it easier for us, or does it make any difference, the age?
I'm not sure the age makes a difference. I do think that each stage of life has its own particular struggle or its particular temptation. And I think the challenge for those of us who are older is that this temptation to live as if our best years are behind us. That is, I think the older we get, the more we tend to dwell in the past. And I think that's a function of two factors. For one thing, we have less of the future in front of us to be concerned about, or at least more accurately, it feels like we have less future in front of us. And, you know, the truth is that the bulk of our lives, our real life is actually yet to come. But I don't have enough specific detail for me to plan for that. You know, I don't really know specifically what I'm going to be doing in eternity. I think the other factor that tends to make those of us who are older more focused in the past is that we have more past. You know, there's more for me to think about it. I think about it more now than I did when I was young, because I have so much more experience that I can dwell on. And I've often noticed this with older people, that the older they get, the more they talk about it in the past. I think of this one elderly gentleman in the congregation that I served as a pastor before I joined the faculty at Moody Bible Institute. And I would go visit him on a regular basis. And he grew up in Japan. His father was a missionary, and he would talk about his father and his experience there as if it was present. You know, it was so vivid to him. He, interestingly, was also very focused on eternity. He spent the last years of his life reading through the book of Revelation every day. So he also had a very clear sense of, you know, that he's moving into eternity. But I think that's what happens to us when we get older, that we automatically, because we have this large body of life experience, we dwell on it. We tend to dwell on it more. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But the reality is, even now, our lives are unfolding in the present. We've got this great legacy of God working in our lives, but he's still at work. You know, he's not back there, and you're not up there in the future where you're going. You're right here, right now.
So wait a minute. The people who say, we just need to get back to the first century church, and we just need to, God was at work there, but what you're saying is, he's at work right now. Don't miss right now in what he's doing.
Yeah, and particularly when you're talking about life in the church, you know, I think for church leaders, it's a great temptation to sort of live in either the church of my imagination or in the church age that I don't dwell in, or I think that's true of life in general. You know, we're always imagining a sort of a better future for ourselves, but the only life you have to live is the one that you're living in, you know, and the place where God is working in your life is in your real circumstance, not your fantasy life, you know, not the, yeah. I'm not saying it's necessarily bad to look at aspects of the church in the New Testament that we admire and say, oh, let's try to make that a reality for us. It's not wrong to have goals. It's not wrong for me to want to make decisions and move in a direction that will improve my life or the congregation's life. But the reality is where God is working is in that mess that you find yourself in the middle of right now. That's where he is. You know, that's he's engaging with you there. That's the only life you have. That's the only context you have for encountering him, not your fantasy life.
You're preaching to me, John, and I'm hearing you, okay?
Okay.
I've been at the same church for 48 years the staff. And looking back, there's beautiful memories that I have, you know, and right now I'm going through a little struggle. But this is where I am, and I'm hearing you loud and clearly. So, you know, I do think what the point you made earlier, nothing really bad with looking back.
No.
When I look back on my life, I'm sure it's probably true with you. I'm just filled with gratitude, you know, to see all that God has done in my life and through my life and, you know, just things I would never have imagined. And so just thanking God, you know, for all the past. But I do want to live in the present as long as I have life. Let's talk a minute about the folks who may be listening who are really looking back and they're haunted by their past. I mean, it's just been, you know, a rough journey for them. What can they do? How do they process that?
Well, one thing I want to make very clear, as I said earlier, when I'm talking about practicing the present, I'm not talking about denial. Practicing the present is not the habit of denying what's happened to me. You know, it's important for those of us who have experienced some kind of either trauma in the past, or maybe they've made some decision or action in the past that, you know, that they are regret and are dwelling on. The consequences of anything like that inevitably follows me into the present. But in order for me to work through that the context where I have to work through that, either the trauma or the past or the my sense of regret over decisions I've made in the past, the context for that work is done in the present. It's done in the here and now. And the bulk of that work is coming to terms with what you might describe as the new normal, you know, the reality of your life situation as it is now shaped. So it's not wrong to reflect on the past. It's not wrong to remember the past. And recovering from any kind of a haunted past, in fact, does require reflection. But that work of recovery is something that is a matter of learning to live in the now rather than living in our minds in our haunted past. Myself, I have a very powerful personal experience with this because I grew up in an alcoholic home where a lot of bad things happened at night. And as a result, I often would find myself waking up in the middle of the night, you know, and sort of reliving that experience, feeling all of that anxiety coming to bear. And I remember one night tossing and turning and feeling this sense of pain and anxiety. And my wife, Jane, asked me what was wrong. And so I told her, and she, you know, she said something very simple but very powerful. She said, "You don't live in that house anymore." And it was life-changing for me. You know, it was funny, later on, I told her that years later how transformative it was. And she said, "Well, I was just trying to think of a way to make you go back to sleep." But, you know, it was one of those moments where God uses somebody to a degree that they, you know, they don't realize, because really that was a way of reorienting me to the present. I can't deny what happened in the past. I can't deny the scars that it has left, or even the ongoing pain that it creates. But, you know, the reality is that I'm living in the here and now. I don't live in that house anymore.
Yeah, I like that. I hope our listeners who are grappling with those kind of memories hear that message.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about this concept of living in the now, living fully, rather than waiting for something, waiting for the thing to happen that will get you past this. And I think, John, a lot of people that are younger are thinking, you know, when I get married or when I graduate or when I am able to do this, then I get a job, et cetera, et cetera. Middle-aged people are doing the same thing. Older people in retirement are doing the same thing. And if you do that long enough, you can't live right now. So that is you want to drag us kicking and screaming into right now, right?
Well, I'm not trying to take anybody anywhere. I'm basically trying to gently remind you that you don't have any other context to live your life in. That's where you are.
Yes.
You know, if you're in denial about it, if I am dwelling on the past and either positively, where it's sort of, you know, kind of a glow. You know how in films, whenever they have a flashback, they put this sort of golden filter on it. We do that in our minds. Or whether it's the other kind of movie, you know, it's a nightmare. It's a kind of a horror story. Or if it's in the future, I'm dreaming about the perfect life that I'm going to have once I get there. That's not where you are. So in a way, it's just to say, pause for a moment, acknowledge the reality of your context, of the reality of your life, with the assumption that God is in it, that that's where you will meet God. If it wasn't for God, I think I would just rather live in my fantasy world. If it wasn't for God, I could dwell on the past that I'm dreaming about, or the future that I'm attaining to, or else if it wasn't for God, I would be stuck in my nightmare. I would be stuck in the horror of whatever has happened to me. It's the reality of God's presence in the broken world in which I now live that makes it, first of all, hopeful to say that, you know, this is the world God himself has entered and chosen to work in, and this is the world in which he meets me, that if I can open my eyes to see the world as it really is, I will see God there, because that's where he's acting.
Hmm. How does this apply to a person who is going through grief? They've lost a spouse to death, or perhaps a child to death. And obviously, there's a lot of emotion and pain and all associated with that. How does this concept apply there?
Well, of course, grief is an emotion, and it's a normal part of processing loss. So living in the now, first of all, it provides me with the space that I need to move through that process of grief, because it's not something I can really rush. It's not like everybody moves through it at the same speed either. You know that on day three, you're going to feel this way, and day 30, you're going to feel this way. It really doesn't work that way. Practicing the present, I think, provides a context for remembering. It provides a context for coming to terms with what I've lost. For those who are grieving, practicing the present is really what I would call the patient process of allowing yourself to become familiar with and eventually comfortable with your new normal. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, if you just wait long enough, the pain will go away. I don't think that's the way grief works either. And if you're in the midst of grief, to describe it as this patient process of allowing yourself to become familiar with and eventually comfortable with the new normal may even sound strange, because you feel like you will never be comfortable again. And it is true that grief inflicts a wound that is always going to be with you. But the reality is that, first of all, you can expect God to offer you comfort, and in time, you will begin to feel more normalized as you move through that process of grief. So practicing the present is, I also think, it's a matter of living truthfully then with your own sense of loss. It is a mindset where you expect God to meet you in the valley. It's not this matter of forcing yourself to move on. That's not at all what I'm talking about. It involves giving yourself the space, the freedom to move through your grief at your own speed. And I think that, you know, this is where I think the disciplines of practicing the present become so important, because in order to do that, you don't have to try to live the life that you once lived, that you can't live anymore. You don't have to put on a happy face, but you do have to tend to the present. That is, the dog needs to be walked and fed. You know, the bed needs to be made. Eventually, you're going to have to go back to work. It's all very mundane. And that's, in fact, part of what makes it, on the one hand, in the early stages, that's part of what makes it so difficult, because you think to yourself, you know, how can I go back to such trivial matters when this terrible, terrible thing has happened? But in time, as you move back into this rhythm of ordinary life, there's a kind of comfort that comes to you as you move back into the rhythms of your life.
John, how about another issue, and that is physical suffering? Mm-hmm. I was talking with a gentleman just recently who said, you know, the last 3 months I've had this severe headache, and the doctors can't, you know, get rid of it. It's just there. I'm living with it. Or other people, very, very common is pain, back pain, for example, that they even had surgeries and all this, but they still live with that constant pain.
Yes.
How does this concept of living in the present relate to that individual?
As I was thinking through this subject, that, to me, that was one of the hardest contexts to think about. I think that may be one of the most challenging dimensions of practicing the present. And let me say, it's certainly not wrong for those who suffer to want that suffering to end. I don't think it's wrong for those who are suffering in that way to put their hope in God's promise for eternity, that our ultimate destiny, if we belong to Christ, is one where there will be no suffering, no pain. That's the hope of the believer. You know, the trajectory of the believer's life does move toward the future. So practicing the present is not pretending to enjoy suffering. And in fact, many of those who have suffered will tell you that the suffering itself does sensitize them to the now. In fact, that, you know, in one sense, I think I would say to that a person like that, they are probably more aware of the present experience than most people are, because it, in a sense, it forces itself upon them. That experience, for many believers, can sensitize them to God. In Psalm 119:71, the psalmist says, "It was good for me to be afflicted." But of course, that's his perspective after the trial's over. If you read through Psalms, you know, you find that his tone is very different when he often cries out, "How long, Lord, will you forget me forever?" Mm-hmm. And I think that's the lesson for somebody who's going through suffering, particularly physical pain. Here you have practicing the present as the discipline of speaking to God with an almost brutal frankness about your situation. I think the great weakness of the church is that we have a tendency to mistake stoicism for grace, so that instead of allowing people to be uncomfortable with their discomfort, everybody's got to put on a happy face, you know. Yeah. All the worship songs are upbeat, you know. So I'd say for the suffering, practicing the present isn't being happy with your suffering. It is acknowledging the reality of your pain. You really, if you're in that situation, you don't have any choice. You don't need anybody to persuade you that you're in pain.
Yeah.
But you do have to be intentional about, I think, directing that to God.
And obviously nothing wrong with continuing to pursue the possibility that there is help.
No, not at all. Let me just say, too, that you know, I almost hesitate to talk about this, because I think for those of us who are not in that position, we are almost inevitably glib when we're talking about that kind of suffering. Only the person who has moved through it with a measure of faith and has experienced the reality of God's presence can actually talk about it with, I think, with credibility. You know, somebody like Johnny can talk about it in a way that I don't think I can.
Well, John, in the last segment, we were talking about suffering, but let's talk about something a little more enjoyable. You talk about food and eating together with other Christians. How does food fit into this living in the present?
Well, and that's something that Christians are experts at, you know. it is. I'm joking about it, but really it is an important part of our church life. And if you think about it, there's probably hardly anything that is more present-oriented than eating, right? It's something we have to do every single day. It's something God has designed us to do. In fact, if we don't eat, we die. It's also very much in the wheelhouse of practicing the present because it's so mundane, you know? It's so common that we hardly even think about it. So I think that we often miss the spiritual significance of ordinary eating. According to Deuteronomy 8, 2 and 3, the Lord reminded Israel of the way that he provided manna in the wilderness in order to teach them a lesson. And the primary lesson, as the Lord puts it, he humbled you, causing you to hunger, and then feeding you with manna, which neither you nor your ancestors had known, to teach you that man does not live on bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Jesus echoes this teaching when he teaches us to pray for daily bread. And I think this underscores a really important but subtle truth that some of our most important needs are not long-term needs, right? They're not needs that are 10 years out. They're needs for the here and now. And it's by God's design. By God's design, our reliance on daily bread is the central element of our most fundamental economy, that is, the way we organize our lives. We eat to live, and we have to rely upon God to provide what we eat.
Yeah.
It's also a community enterprise. And here, when I'm talking about it that way, I'm drawing on the thinking of Wendell Berry. Eating is a community enterprise because most of us don't produce our own food. It takes a community to create the context where the food is produced and I can get access to it. So it's economic in that sense, but it's very interesting that the term economy comes from the Greek word for household. And in most cases, eating is a household activity. You know, so that it is a community enterprise. It is a communal enterprise, and the community implications of eating were actually embedded in the law of Moses, which required growers to leave grain behind that dropped, to leave it there for the poor. I think when you come into the New Testament, you know, when you look at the ministry of Jesus. One of the criticisms of Jesus was his eating and drinking. Jesus says in Matthew 11:19, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And of course, we all know the Lord's Supper, the practice of the Lord's Supper comes out of the Last Supper, which implies that there were many other suppers, that an important part of Jesus' interaction with the disciples was this communal, this fellowship experience of eating together. So I think it elevates the whole experience of eating, of sharing meals, so that ordinary eating is a reminder of God's provision for us. It's a context for experiencing the reality of God's presence. In a way, every ordinary meal points to the inevitability of God's care in our lives. Jesus uses that as teaching for us, you know. He says, your Father knows what you need before you ask him. So every bite is a reminder of Christ's promise that the Father knows what we need. And in a way, every ordinary meal is a feast, not so much because of the menu, but because of the company that we enjoy as we partake. Company of our friends, the company of our family, and the reality that as we eat together in community, God is present with us.
You know, John, in the Christian community, of course, we often bow and give thanks to God before we partake of the food. But I found that sometimes that gets to be routine, and whatever we say the same thing, rather than really being conscious of the presence of God and really reflecting on, you know, the gratitude that this is in front of me because a lot of other people worked, you know, to get it here. And even to pray for those people. You know, you get an orange from California and pray for the man or woman who picked it from the tree and the truck driver that brought it across. We don't think about those things.
No, we don't. We don't recognize how interconnected we are. And this act of eating together, which I think we are doing more and more in isolation, you know, it is a vivid, tangible reminder. And I have to tell you, I mean, I'm just the same as everybody else. You know, I have to really think about it. I don't want to give the impression like, yeah, every time I have a meal, it's like this really spiritual, you know, experience.
Yeah, sometimes people say, and bless the hands that prepared this meal.
Yeah.
You know, but again, that can be routine. Well, I would say, if your wife prepared the meal, why not say thank you for Lucille her work, you know, in preparing this meal.
And that, you know, let me say one other thing about the routineness of it, that, you know, in a way, though, that is also kind of a blessing. That is part of this, for me, the sort of the theology of living in the present. It's, the theology of the ordinary, that we have all of these kinds of actions that we take, that they are so common to us that they feel instinctive. You know, I actually think that's a blessing, that they become so worked into the grain of our lives that it is the way that God reinforces. So we pray that little prayer, you know, of thanks, or we bless the hands that prepared the food. God takes us at our word, even if we don't really realize what we've said.
If we're not thinking seriously about it.
Right.
No, I agree. John, we know that that we are all bombarded every day with things on television, social media, about the newest thing. How does practicing the present free us from needing to follow the next best thing, you know, trying to find a little more satisfaction?
Well, I think that we are living in, on the one hand, we are living in a culture where we have been trained to be dissatisfied with our lives. You know, that's what marketing does. It basically bombards us with a message that whatever you have is not good enough. You need something different. You need a better life. And we also are living in a culture that's oriented toward immediate gratification. And you might even think that the search for immediate gratification is kind of the ultimate expression of living in the now. You know, whatever I want, I go for. But I actually think it's the opposite. I think that the search for immediate satisfaction is really an attempt to escape the present. The same with the search for the next best thing is based on the assumption that whatever comes next is going to be better than what I have now. Practicing the present, number one, gives me permission to enjoy the ordinary. You know, it gives me permission to be blessed by the mundane. One of the things that bothers me about the culture of the way we talk about our lives in the church today is how hyperbolic everything is. You know, at the beginning of some service, someone will say, you know, your life will never be the same after this. Well, frankly, most of the time it is that, you know, or I always have to be doing something great. You know, I have to, why can't I just cut the grass? why can't I just work in the garden and that's good enough? You know, that why can't my ordinary work and my ordinary life be an offering to God that pleases Him and provides a context for my knowing Him better? Why does everything have to be extreme? And I think practicing the present anchors me in this God-given reality it allows me to see that maybe what I have, maybe the things that God has provided for me right now, maybe they really are good enough. Maybe he really has provided all that I need for today.
Well, John, this has been a fascinating conversation. We could go another hour on this topic. And I'm sure that our listeners are tuning into this because it's a call to live life where we are. So, first of all, thank you for taking the time and energy to write this book. And thank you for being with us today to share it with our listeners.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
I knew this hour would fly by because this is a topic many people are living in the now. I think you'll really be helped by our featured resource today, Practicing the Present, The Neglected Art of Living in the Now. Dr. John Kessler has been our guest. You can go to 5lovelanguages.com and find out more. 5lovelanguages.com.
And coming up next week, we open the phone lines for our first Dear Gary broadcast of the fall season.
Don't miss the questions and the answers in 1 week. A big thank you to our production team, Steve Wick, Ryan McConaughey, and Janice Todd. Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman is a production of Moody Radio in association with Moody Publishers, a ministry of Moody Bible Institute. Thanks for listening.